And then, you know that mold is at an all-time high today, which is the one thing I am allergic to. Pollen is down.
Mold is up.
Mold is up. You know, I know that as a matter of fact, because I was watching CBS this morning.
There you go.
Now that I think about it.
Learn something new every day.
Indeed.
See you, Chris. I'm going to just snap it once. Good?
Yep. Coming around. Don?
Yeah.
Got it on both?
Okay, so we need to clear the background.
Good, Don?
Yes.
Thank you, Tim.
No problem. Just do what you need to do.
Rome, perfectly happy?
Everybody happy? Good?
I'm good.
All right. Well, Madam Vice President, one, thank you for doing this.
Of course.
And thank you for inviting us into your home.
Of course.
We're going to be running this on the anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel.
October 7th.
So let's just start with Israel.
Hang on 1 second, Bill.
Yeah.
Sorry, we had someone in the background. I'm afraid you're going to have to re-ask that.
Okay, whoever's in the dining room?
It was me.
Okay.
So yeah, just to start with Israel.
Okay.
The events of the past few weeks have pushed us to the brink, if not into, an all-out regional war in the Middle East. What can the U.S. do at this point to stop this from spinning out of control?
Well, let's start with October 7, because obviously what we do now must be in the context of what has happened. And as I reflect on a year ago, and that 1,200 people were massacred, young people at a festival, at a music festival, 250 hostages were taken, including Americans. Women were brutally raped. And as I said then, I maintain Israel has a right to defend itself, we would, and how it does so matters. And as we fast forward into what we have seen in the ensuing weeks and months, far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we know that, and I think most agree, this war has to end. And that has to be our number one imperative. And that has been our number one imperative. How can we get this war to end? Well, critical elements of that are we have got to get a hostage deal and a ceasefire deal done. We have to get aid in. We have to lay the path toward a two-state solution. I do believe that we must maintain that as an objective, no matter how out of reach it seems at the moment. And the work that we have to do is also pay attention to what is happening every day in the region and put U.S. resources into everything we can do diplomatically and otherwise to de-escalate what is happening in the region.
We supply Israel with billions of dollars in military aid, and yet Prime Minister Netanyahu seems to be charting his own course. The Biden-Harris administration has pressed him to agree to a ceasefire. He's resisted. You urged him not to go into Lebanon. He went in anyway. He has promised to make Iran pay for the missile attack, and that has the potential of expanding the war. Does the U.S. have no sway over Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Well, let's start with this. On this subject, the aid that we have given Israel allowed Israel to defend itself against 200 ballistic missiles that were just meant to attack the Israelis and the people of Israel. And I think that is the most recent example of why what we do to assist in their defense around military aid is important. And when we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is, without any question, our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks. Now, the work that we do diplomatically, with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop in terms of putting that pressure on Israel and in the region, including with other leaders in the region, including Arab leaders.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening. The Wall Street Journal said that that your administration has repeatedly been blindsided by Netanyahu. And in fact, he has rebuffed just about all of your administration's entreaties.
Well, Bill, the work that we have done has resulted in a number of movements in that region by Israel that were very much prompted by or a result of many things, including our advocacy for what needs to happen in the region. And we're not going to stop doing that. We are not going to stop pursuing what is necessary for the United States to be clear about where we stand on the need for this war to end.
Just one last, do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I think, with all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer to that question is yes. And we are going to do what is important to support whatever leadership is in Israel that is defending the security of the state of Israel.
Let's shift gears here. Most basic of questions. Why do you want to be President of the United States?
There are many reasons, but probably first and foremost, I truly believe in the promise of America. I do. And I love the American people. You know, we are a people who have ambition and aspirations and dreams and optimism and hope. If you look at the character of who we are and how we have achieved the strength that we have achieved, I believe in large part it is because of our character and our belief in the promise of America. And I'm running for president because I want to do everything that is possible to create an opportunity for people to achieve those goals, those ambitions, and those dreams. And that is why you will hear me talk about my plan for an opportunity economy, to invest in what we can do, not only to bring the cost of living and prices down for folks, because even though we've achieved a lot of success, prices are still too high. You know it, I know it. But what we can do to invest in the innovation that is happening in startups and our small businesses, what we can do to invest in the industries of the future, what we can do to maintain America's strength in the global context.
But that's why you want to run. That's why you want to be
That's why I'm
president.
Running. That and some other reasons.
But you're asking the American people to make you the most powerful person on the planet. Mm-hmm. Why do you deserve the American people's votes?
Well, first of all, I have a career and a history of being very clear that I think of my role of leadership, and in particular now for the last 4 years as vice president and moving forward as president, if the voters will have me, as being a leader on behalf of all Americans. As you know, I spent the majority of my career as a prosecutor. And I'm going to tell you, I never asked a victim of crime, a witness, whether they were a Democrat, are you a Republican, are you an independent. The only thing I ever asked folks is, are you okay? And I believe that America deserves a leader who works on behalf of all Americans and understands the importance of knowing that the vast majority of us have so much more in common than what separates us. And my career and my work has always been about being grounded in common sense approaches to getting things done. Mm. And when it comes to what we need to do as it relates to national security, we just had that conversation. That includes understanding and respecting the power and the strength of the United States of America and our then responsibility to be a global leader, to nurture and strengthen our alliances around the world, to respect the U.S. military and its most noble mission, to do the work of appreciating alliances, be it NATO or others, to do the work of pursuing diplomacy when it is in the best interest of our national security and prosperity. Mm. And my experiences tell me not only that those must be priorities of the United States of America and the President of the United States of America and the Commander-in-Chief of the United States of America, but also all of those experiences tell me that the American people in this election have a clear choice. Because on the other side of the equation, we are looking at the former president, Donald Trump, who has shown himself to be, when he was a commander-in-chief, someone who gave away America's standing in terms of our principles of standing up to dictators and autocrats. You see how he compliments Putin even today. Someone who was prepared to walk away from our alliances. NATO is the strongest military alliance the world has ever known. We have seen someone in Donald Trump who openly criticizes the United States military, men and women, who are prepared to, at great sacrifice, serve our country and defend the principles upon which we were founded. He calls them suckers and losers.
But Madam Vice President, a quarter of registered voters still say they don't know you. They don't know what makes you tick. And why do you think that is? I mean, you have been vice president for almost 4 years. You've been on the national scene for longer. What's the disconnect?
It's an election, Bill. And I take it seriously that I have to earn everyone's vote. And that's why I'm traveling our country. I've seen you in a few states in the last couple of days. I am talking with folks where they live. I am listening to folks and working to earn the vote of every American. This is an election for President of the United States. No one should be able to take for granted that they can just declare themselves a candidate and automatically receive support. You have to earn it. And that's what I intend to do.
Let me tell you what your critics and the columnists say.
Okay.
They say that the reason so many voters don't know you is that you have changed your position on so many things. You were against fracking, now you're for it. You supported looser immigration policies, now you're tightening them up. You were for Medicare for all, now you're not. So many that people don't truly know what you believe or what you stand for. And I know you've heard that.
So let's be clear. First of all, a lot of the positions that you were talking about have been discussed and mm-hmm. dispensed with in 2020, 4 years ago. But let me be clear on something. In the last 4 years, I have been Vice President of the United States. Not a senator from a particular state, not coming from a particular state, but Vice President of the United States of America. And I have been traveling our country, and I have been listening to folks and seeking what is possible in terms of common ground, common sense solutions, building consensus. And that is why I have taken the positions that I take, not dispensing with my values, but understanding we have to, a real leader has to find consensus. Mm. So, for example, on the issue of fracking, I've been very clear since 2020. I will not end fracking. I did not as vice president. In fact, as vice president of the United States, I cast the decisive vote. I broke the tie in Congress that now allows more leases for fracking. On the issue of health care in America, my value has always been that access to health care should be a right and not just a privilege of those who can afford it, which is why I cast the tie-breaking vote in the United States Congress that has now allowed us to cap the cost of insulin for seniors at $35 a month. The work that I have been a part of and helped lead about capping the cost of prescription medication for our seniors at $2,000 a year, all born out of my belief that we need to bring the price of medication down because it has been too expensive for too many people to the point that they couldn't even afford to fill their prescription. That's why I've been a huge advocate for what we have accomplished finally to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices on behalf of the American people.
You have said that your values haven't changed, but your positions have. And I think people want to know, is this evolution or, as your critics say, opportunism?
I think that we should understand the importance of a leader building consensus. I believe in building consensus. And I believe in finding a way that the American people, and we are a diverse people, geographically, regionally, based on whether it be urban, rural, agricultural, we are a diverse people in terms of where we are in our backgrounds. And what the American people do want is that we have leaders who can build consensus, where we can figure out compromise and understand it's not a bad thing, as long as you don't compromise your values, to find common sense solutions. And that has been my approach.
Let's move on to the economy. As you were saying, well, first of all, the economy and inflation, those are the primary concerns of the American voters this election year. You just got some blockbuster jobs report, a blockbuster job report the other day. And there are lots of signs that the American economy is doing very well, better than most countries, I think. But the American people don't seem to be feeling it. Groceries are 25% higher than when you took office. And people are blaming you and Joe Biden for that. Are they wrong?
So you are correct that under our leadership, the United States of America has recovered and is stronger than any other so-called developed nation in the world, in particular after the crisis that was the pandemic. And understand, we came into office facing a disaster in large part because of the mismanagement of the former president, Donald Trump, where the economy was in a slump, people were dying by the hundreds. It was a real crisis. But because of our approach and our work, we now have historic low unemployment in America among all groups of people. We now have an economy that is thriving by all macroeconomic measures. We have recovered in a way that we have created almost 800,000 new manufacturing jobs. We have created over 16 million new jobs as a whole. And to your point, prices are still too high. And I know that, and we need to deal with it, which is why part of my plan, you mentioned groceries, part of my plan is what we must do to bring down the price of groceries. I'm taking on an issue I've taken on before as Attorney General, the issue of price gouging, which is not all, but some corporations and businesses that take advantage of a crisis and jack prices up, making the cost of groceries and other everyday essentials too expensive for the American people.
But you're,
I'm taking on the issue of housing. It's a big issue in our country. It's too expensive. There were generations before us that believed they could achieve the American dream, which included home ownership. Now, I travel our country. I talk to young people every day. And they are so concerned they'll never be able to afford to buy a home or even start a family because of the cost of housing. So part of my plan is to put the resources into partnering with builders and developers to create incentives for them to build 3 million new homes by the end of my first term, and my plan includes giving first-time homebuyers a $25,000 down payment assistance so they can just get their foot in the door.
Well, let's talk about that. You want to expand the child tax credit.
Yes, I do.
You want to give tax breaks to first-time homebuyers.
Yes.
And people starting small businesses.
Correct.
But it is estimated by the Nonpartisan Committee for Responsible Federal Budget that your economic plan would add $3 trillion to the federal deficit over the next decade. How are you going to pay for that?
Okay, so the other economists that have reviewed my plan versus my opponent, because this is an election and there are two choices. Everyone from Goldman Sachs to Moody's to 16 Nobel laureates. So on the first point, comparing my economic plan to Donald Trump's economic plan, they have reviewed it and determined that my economic plan would strengthen America's economy, his would weaken it. 16 Nobel laureates, Moody's, others, have determined after reviewing what Donald Trump is proposing, that he would induce inflation, increase inflation, and bring about a recession by the middle of next year.
But
my plan, Bill, if you don't mind, my plan is about saying that when you invest in small businesses, you invest in the middle class, and you strengthen America's economy. Small businesses are part of the backbone of America's economy.
But pardon me, Madam Vice President, the question was, how are you going to pay for it?
Well, one of the things is I'm going to make sure that the richest among us who can afford it pay their fair share in taxes. Listen, again, my opponent, when he was president, issued a tax cut for people like himself, billionaires and the biggest corporations. My perspective is everybody needs to pay their fair share. It is not right that teachers and nurses and firefighters are paying a higher tax rate than billionaires and the biggest corporations.
But
I plan on making that fair.
But we're dealing with the real world here.
But the real world includes...
How are you going to get this through Congress?
You know, when you talk quietly with a lot of folks in Congress, they know exactly what I'm talking about because their constituents know exactly what I'm talking about. Their constituents are those firefighters and teachers and nurses. Their constituents are middle-class, hardworking folk who know that it is not right that hardworking people are paying a higher tax rate than the richest people who can afford to pay their fair share. So that's how we deal with it. But understand also that this is, yes, it is about how we pay for what we're doing, but understand it doesn't end there. My plan is actually about strengthening America's economy, not just netting zero. My plan is about doing what we can do for small businesses and startups. Right now, the tax deduction, Bill, for a startup, $5,000. In 2024, nary a person going to be able to start a small business with $5,000. So I'm going to extend it to $50,000. My plan is about what we need to do, yes, expand the child tax credit, because for young families, for the first year of their child's life, $6,000 allows them to buy a crib, a car seat, and just be able to not just get by, but get ahead for that most critical stage of their child's development. We all benefit from that. We all benefit from that.
I understand, but that sounds great. It does. It all sounds good. But the reality is these tax cuts have been in place for years.
They're about to expire.
Yes, and Congress has shown no inclination to move in your direction.
I disagree with you. There are plenty of leaders in Congress who understand and know that the Trump tax cuts blew up our federal deficit and care about the deficit in a way that they know. We must address it by making sure that our tax policy reflects fairness, and again, understand none of us, and certainly I cannot afford to be myopic in terms of how I think about strengthening America's economy. And that has to include, where are we investing our resources in a way that we maximize the return on the investment? Let me tell you something. I am a devout public servant. You know that. I am also a capitalist. And I know the limitations of government. Part of the work I've always done and the work I will do as president includes engaging the private sector to join in what we can do, whether it be, again, tax incentives for builders or developers, or what we need to do to increase the work I've already done to get some of our biggest finance houses and corporations to invest in community banks to increase access to capital for small businesses. So all of this work must be done, but we have to have a holistic approach that is comprehensive.
I guess what I was asking, if all of this makes so much sense, why has this not been done? You are dealing with a Congress that is divided, that many are in opposition to not only you but your policies. So how are you going to make this come true?
Bill, if I approached my life as though, well, it's never been done before, therefore it cannot be done, I wouldn't be sitting here in this interview with you. That's the truth. But I do believe that we have to have leadership in our country as we turn the page on all of these sadly powerful forces that have been trying to divide us. We have to turn the page on that and chart a new way forward that is driven by building consensus and building common ground. Listen, you look at my campaign. I am supported by over 200 former members of Mitt Romney, John McCain, both President Bush, and even former President Trump's teams. I have the support of Republicans who understand what is at stake in this election, be it as it relates to our democracy and our most fundamental principles, and I do believe, based on a collective understanding we have, that America's politics has to get back to the place of encouraging healthy debate, but not division for the sake of division. Hmm.
Just a couple more economic story questions here.
Sure.
Donald Trump says that tariffs on imports, that would be the solution to all of our economic woes. You criticize his plan for tariffs, yet the Biden-Harris administration has left many of the Trump-era tariffs in place, especially when it regards China. And President Biden has, in fact, expanded some of those tariffs. Would you continue the Trump-era tariffs if you're elected?
So part of the real problem that economists and others have pointed out about Trump's approach in this election, he is advocating what is at least a 20% tariff across the board on everyday necessities and goods, which economists have estimated will cost the average American family more than almost $4,000 a year, more than what they're already paying.
But you've got tariffs.
Goods, but let me get to my point. On everyday goods, so a across-the-board blanket policy on tariffs for everyday goods and necessities. Tariff policy we cannot afford to have that is just a blind policy without looking at what we are talking about and what will it induce, what will it incentivize. On the point about China, look, America has to win the competition for the 21st century as it relates to China. And we need to have policy that includes investing in America, investing in American workers, investing in American manufacturing, investing in American supply chain. And that is, I believe, smart and important policy, not only for the sake of our security, but also our prosperity.
So let's move on to immigration. You recently visited the southern border and embraced President Biden's recent crackdown on asylum seekers. And that crackdown produced an almost immediate and dramatic decrease in the number of border crossings. And you said you would take it even further. If that's the right answer now, why didn't your administration take those steps in 2021?
So we came into office And almost hours, Bill, after our inauguration, the first bill we proposed to Congress was to fix our broken immigration system, knowing that if you want to actually fix it, we need Congress to act. It was not taken up. Fast forward to a moment when a bipartisan group of members of the United States Senate, including one of the most conservative members of the United States Senate, got together, came up with a border security bill, which I support. Well, guess what happened? Donald Trump got word that this bill was afoot and could be passed, knowing that it could fix part of the problem, and he wants to run on a problem instead of fixing a problem, so he told his buddies in Congress, kill the bill, don't let it move forward.
But Madam Vice President, I've been covering the border for years, and so I know this is not a problem that started with your administration.
Correct.
But there was an historic flood of undocumented immigrants coming across the border the first 3 years of your administration. As a matter of fact, arrivals quadrupled from the last year of President Trump. Was it a mistake to loosen the immigration policies as much as you did in 2021?
So regionally and actually globally, we have seen this as an issue. And America's obviously not immune from this issue. But the focus has to be, to your point, you've been covering it for years, it's a long-standing problem. And solutions are at hand. And from day one, literally, we have been offering solutions, which have not been picked up. And then when there was a border security bill, my opponent decided to run on the problem instead of fixing the problem. And understand what that bill would have done. That border security bill would have put 1,500 more agents at the border, which is why the Border Patrol Union supported it. Mm-hmm. It would have put more resources into stemming the flow of fentanyl.
But that was just this
scourge.
Past year. That was just this past year. What I was asking was it a mistake to kind of allow that flood to happen in the first place?
I think the policies that we have been proposing are about fixing a problem, not promoting a problem. Okay.
But the numbers did quadruple.
And the numbers today,
your watch.
Because of what we have done, we have cut the flow of illegal immigration by half.
But should you have done that? Should you have done that?
We have cut the flow of fentanyl by half. But we need Congress to be able to act, to actually fix the problem. I was just at the border.
Yeah.
I'm talking with these incredible men and women who are working around the clock because, again, they don't have the resources they need. We need an act of Congress who carries the purse to do it. Donald Trump told them don't act. I talked with the Border Patrol agents, some of the leaders. Part of the issue that they identified is we need more asylum judges. We need more processing of people who are coming to our border, and the resources aren't there. You know how those resources, commensurate with the need, get dedicated? Congress has to act.
But I guess my question is, it's a pretty simple one. If this is the right answer now, what you tried to do with the bipartisan bill,
and what we tried to do on day one, Bill, and what we tried to do on day one, when we came in, first order of business before we did the Inflation Reduction Act, before we did, successfully, by the way, without one Republican vote, mm-hmm. before we did the bipartisan infrastructure bill, before we passed the first meaningful piece of legislation to deal with gun violence in America in 30 years, the first thing we did was to offer a comprehensive solution to create a pathway for citizenship and for people to earn it and to deal with what we need to do to put more resources to ensure that we are able to heighten our level of security at the border.
So we do need to move on because our time is short, but I'm trying to understand how it is that with this emphasis on the border, the numbers of crossings quadrupled under the first 3 years of the Biden-Harris administration. How did that happen?
There are a variety of factors that relate to what we have seen globally and what we are not immune from at our own border in terms of what we have seen in terms of surge of immigration and irregular migration. And there are solutions at hand, but we've got to have leaders who are solution-oriented, which we've been and are, and I am going forward, instead of leaders who want to make it a problem they can run on. Hmm.
It's talking about that person you're mentioning right now. You have accused Donald Trump of using racist tropes when it comes to Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, when it comes to birtherism, when it comes to Charlottesville. In fact, you have called him a racist and divisive. Yet Donald Trump has the support of millions and millions of Americans. How do you explain that?
So let's just break down what you just talked about and talk about it in the context of the words that Donald Trump has spoken and the actions he has taken, and whether that is reflective of who we are as Americans, knowing we have so much more in common than what separates us. We have a former president who wants to be president again, who has a bouquet of microphones in front of him, who has said the most vile lies about a group of legal immigrants in Springfield, Ohio. And if I may, Bill, let me just say something. You know, from the time I was a prosecutor to attorney general to now vice president, I learned very early in my career, when the voters bestow on you the authority to have these positions, you must be very thoughtful about how you use that microphone in front of you. And, you know, when I was attorney general, the words I spoke could move markets. So the idea that the former president, who again is running to be president, would use that microphone in a way that is about vilifying and demeaning a whole population of people, you know what has happened because of that? One day when this happened was a school day, picture day for an elementary school. Picture day. You know what picture day is mm-hmm. for our children. They get excited the night before. You put out the clothes they're going to wear. They go to school making sure their faces are clean and their hair is done. And they go to school for picture day. And you know what happened to these children? They had to evacuate that day because of the fear of the threats that were being issued in Springfield because of the words of Donald Trump. So I say that I'm glad you are pointing these comments out that he has made that have resulted in a response by most reasonable people to say it's just wrong. It's just wrong.
So you have said you want to be the president of all the people.
Yes.
With so many people supporting Donald Trump, a man you've called a racist, how do you bridge that seemingly unbridgeable gap?
I believe that the people of America want a leader who's not trying to divide us and demean. I believe that the American people recognize that the true measure of the strength of a leader is not based on who you beat down, it's based on who you lift up. And I have traveled around our country, and I've met with people of every background and walk of life, including people who have supported Donald Trump in the past, who say to me they're ready to turn the page, they're exhausted with what he has been doing and that approach, and they want to chart a new way forward for our country.
So, was democracy best served by President Biden stepping down and basically handing you a nomination? You didn't have to go through a primary process. You didn't have to fight off other contenders. That's not really the way our system was intended to work.
So President Biden made a decision that I think history is going to show is rare among leaders, which was to put country before self.
Excuse me.
And I am proud to have earned the support of the vast majority of delegates and to have been elected the Democratic nominee to be Vice President of the United States. I am honored to have received the support and endorsement of over 200 Republicans who served in the last three Republican presidential administrations. I am proud to have earned the support of leaders of our national security community. I am proud to have received the endorsement of leaders around this country from every background and walk of life to fight in this election over the next month for our democracy and the principles upon which it stands. What is at stake in this election? You mentioned our democracy, is whether we are a nation that abides by and respects the rule of law, and that we have a president who is the champion of following and respecting and upholding rule of law.
But I would
not
think
someone
that
who has been convicted of 34 felonies, who tried to overturn the free and fair election, which was the will of the people on January 6th, not someone who has said he would be a dictator on day one, not someone who has said, and these are his words, he would terminate the Constitution of the United States of America.
But I think this truncated process is why people think or say they don't really know who you are.
Well, Bill, there's no question. Look, I've been in this race for 70 days, and there is work to be done. It is, without any question, a short period of time. There's no question about that, which is why I'm traveling around our country. As I said earlier, I mean, you've seen me. I'm from one state to the next. I don't know how many states I've been in this last week alone. Literally, I've lost count. So it is my responsibility to earn the vote, and I'm going to work to do that.
Three quarters of the American voters, or likely voters, say that they are concerned about the possibility of election-related violence. And with two assassination attempts against former President Trump, the country seems near a boiling point. What can you do, what should you do to lower the temperature?
Well, first let's start with those attempts, assassination attempts on the former president. I was deeply disturbed, shocked, and shaken, frankly, when they happened. I called the former president to check on him. But it is really important that all of us speak loudly, regardless of who we're voting for, to say our differences have to be settled at the ballot box and not through violence. We cannot lose our soul in terms of who we are as Americans by resorting to violence to settle our differences, much less to make a decision about who's going to be the next president of the United States.
Let's hit on some more foreign policy.
There's a bug in here.
Which foreign country do you consider to be our greatest adversary?
Well, there are different reasons that we should be thoughtful about each. Most recently, I think there's an obvious one in mind, which is Iran. And look, I mean, Iran has American blood on their hands, okay? And what we saw in terms of just this attack on Israel, 200 ballistic missiles, what we need to do to ensure that Iran never achieves the ability to be a nuclear power, that is one of my highest priorities.
So if you have proof that Iran is building a nuclear weapon, would you take military action?
I'm not going to talk about hypotheticals at this moment.
What about China? China is strongly asserting its dominance, its control of the South China Sea, especially around the Philippines. What is the U.S. responsibility for keeping China from simply taking over the South China Sea?
Well, I have actually worked very closely with the leaders in the Philippines on just this very issue, and including the work that we are doing in terms of coordination between our military and training and what needs to happen in terms of protecting the freedom of the South China Sea. China, first of all, we must win the competition for the 21st century with China. We must be able to compete and win. We should not seek conflict. But we have to understand that there are parameters in which we must operate that include ensuring, for example, that we protect American business interests.
So say if China attacks Taiwan, would we use military force to support Taiwan?
Bill, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals, but listen, we need to make sure that we maintain a one-China policy, but that includes supporting Taiwan's ability to defend itself, including what we need to do to ensure the freedom of the Taiwan Strait. But on the issue of China, we also, again, these are not, we cannot afford to have foreign policy that is myopic. We must be able to also, as it relates to China, continue to do the work that we have begun to deal with the flow of fentanyl coming into the United States. That's a real issue. Again, you talk to families around our country who I've on a constant, sadly, regular basis, meet parents and family members of people who have died from fentanyl, young people who have died from fentanyl. Are we going to stop trying to stem the flow of fentanyl? And we have to deal with that and understand China's role in that and our ability to work with China to stop that flow, which we have begun to do and I'm going to continue to do. We need to make sure we have open lines of communication with China, in particular, military to military. So these issues are all, they're multifaceted.
So what about Russia and Ukraine? What does the end of the war, what does success look like in ending the war in Ukraine?
There will be no success in ending that war without Ukraine and the UN Charter participating in what that success looks like. Being said, America must stand firm in being a leader in defending international rules and norms that include one of the most important, which is the critical nature and importance of sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Would you meet with President Vladimir Putin to negotiate a solution to the war in Ukraine?
Not bilaterally without Ukraine, no. Ukraine must have a say in the future of Ukraine.
How about, as president, would you support the effort to expand NATO to include Ukraine?
Those are all issues that we will deal with if and when it arrives at that point. Right now, we are supporting Ukraine's ability to defend itself against Russia's unprovoked aggression and doing what we can to continue to build and strengthen the alliance around the support for Ukraine's right to be an independent nation, free from having its borders forcefully taken by Russia. And we are going to continue to work closely with our NATO allies to continue to reinforce America's alliance in the context of NATO. Again, in this election, there's a real difference between me and the former president. I believe in reinforcing the strength of NATO, understanding, again, it is the greatest military alliance the world has ever known. Donald Trump would pull us out of NATO. Donald Trump, if he were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now. Let's be clear about that. He talks about, he can end it on day one. You know what that is? It's about surrender. Achieving peace and an end to this war is not synonymous with surrender. Those two things are not the same.
It's a hard left turn here, but you recently surprised people when you said that you are a gun owner And then if someone came into your house...
That was not the first time I've talked about it. That's not the first time I've talked about it. But it's, I mean, I don't talk about it a lot, but...
So what kind of gun do you own, and when and why did you get it?
I have a Glock, and I've had it for quite some time. And, I mean, look, Bill, my background is in law enforcement. And so there you go.
Have you ever fired it?
Yes. Of course I have. At a shooting range? Yes, of course I have. And to just give you more detail, and I store it in a locked box. And it is safely stored, and as any responsible gun owner does.
I'm getting the countdown here, but one last thing. You are sitting here with us. Mm-hmm. The Trump campaign canceled an interview that they had agreed to participate in this broadcast. What do you make of that?
Listen, I think that, look, I think that your viewers have options in terms of how they're gonna hear from him. And I invite them to watch what he says at his rallies. If he is not gonna give your viewers the ability to have a meaningful, thoughtful conversation, question and answer with you, then watch his rallies. And what you're going to hear are comments about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. You're going to hear conversations of suggesting that human beings are eating their pets. You're going to hear conversations that are about himself and all of his personal grievances, words that are intended to divide our country is what you will hear, and what you will not hear is anything about you, the listener. You will not hear a plan about how he's gonna make your life better. You will not hear a plan about how he's gonna strengthen the middle class. You will not hear about how he is going to strengthen small businesses. You will not hear about how he's gonna try to bring the country together, find common ground. And Bill, that is why I believe in my soul and heart the American people are ready to turn the page.
You have said that the country is exhausted.
Yes.
With the rhetoric and the finger pointing. How about you? Are you exhausted?
I'll be exhausted on November 6th, not now. Not now. Too much to do. Too much to do.
Madam Vice President, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Good to be with you.
Oh, can we just get just a little bit of a question, please, so I can get over the shoulder shot?
Yeah.
Just a second. Okay. Thank you.
You need me talking?
Yes, sir.
Well, we were talking about how you're going to pay for it, and I mean, I truly do mean it. I, you know, your plans are logical, make logical sense. Mm-hmm. The way Washington works is not logical. So, how are you going to convince a divided Congress that what you say, your plans, are something that they should all agree to and provide to the American people when they've shown no inclination to do that up to this point?
Is that what you needed?
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, ma'am. 30 seconds of silence, please, for room time.